Okay, well, in that case, I'll start. So the trust of the work has been going on for a little while now. I guess the DARPA funding has sort of accelerated things, but we were actually doing some stuff before then. There are a number of components to the work, and what I'm actually mostly going to do is talk a little bit about the mandatory access control framework and a little bit about the ACLs, and so those are probably the two big things that are happening for 5.0 release, since the auditing work is probably not going to be finished in time. We lost Andrew somewhere. Yeah, won't be finished.
Hiding in the corner.
Yes, okay. I guess what I'll talk...
Now attending...
Chris Costello, Houston, Texas.
Hello, Chris.
Good day, Chris.
Hello, how's it going?
Okay, so... So we're about to begin. Okay, so the trusted BS work contains a number of components, and I'll sort of briefly go through them and then talk a little bit in detail about the components where I think actually feedback would be extremely useful. Essentially, the goal is to introduce some new security features that are going to support new kinds of operation that that some of our consumers need who previously haven't been consumers, in some cases have been. This is the most basic component that we introduced first was the ACL work, which brings in fine-grained ACLs, and people can debate the usefulness of ACLs on Unix, and I certainly would. But there are a lot of people who ask for it, and well, that's fine. To support that, we need extended attributes, and to implement extended attributes, there is a new implementation of extended attributes coming as part of the UFS2 work, which addresses many of the concerns of the current implementation, primarily performance and reliability. The current implementation in FreeBSD5 has low performance and low reliability. We would like both of those lows to turn to highs. And so that should actually make the ACL stuff be pretty production-worthy. There are a couple more patches that Chris Ballhaber has that need to be committed to userline to make a couple of the userline utilities do the right thing. But otherwise, we're pretty much there. The hope is that we will be able to support ACLs and default file systems using UFS2 without any special configuration activities, but we won't pay any of the costs of doing so unless somebody turns them on. So. Yes?
How to become very popular.
We're going to hang it up one of these things.
I'll set the building on fire.
Well, we're not
thinking
of building
or
anything that's true.
That would make us really popular.
Water,
water is they may need mist at that end of the table. I don't know.
Is that why they're at
their level? Yeah, I'm dying for a minute. It's just
at the lobby. You know what it is? At the lobby. At the lobby.
I'll have to get more water, though.
Oh, worked real well.
Who are you trying to get?
I don't know.
I was trying to get it all the way down there.
Yeah, let me ask.
Well, but you didn't know how to do
it. I do. I was just worried.
Okay.
Well, you can keep it if you want to.
No.
I'm fine. I'm fine. Really. Okay, we're going to try and start again. This is the second try now. Okay, so this is try two. Try two. Okay.
Try two.
Try two. Okay, so ACLs, they work, and they're going to be fun, and everyone will be happy. The more interesting work is actually right now in the mandatory access control framework, and I talked a little bit about this in the work in progress presentation, I guess, last night?
Wednesday night.
And the goal of that is to allow you to modify some of the security models present in the kernel to enforce new restrictions. And the primary consumers of that right now are some of the formal mandatory access control models, such as multi-level security and integrity policies and so on. But also, part of a new component of our funding is to port some of the SE Linux work to FreeBSD. And so that will also be resting on top of it is the Flask framework and the type enforcement implementation from NSA. So those will also be resting on the same interface. And what I'll do now is actually talk a little bit about how that works. For those who were at the work in progress session, this will be somewhat of a refresher, the same content almost. But one of the reasons I want to present this and get people to discuss it is that there are a couple of concerns relating to performance, and there are interactions with the network system and so on, which are probably worth discussing. And one of those issues came up already, which is the ability to add additional metadata to packets as they pass through the network system, because one of the things you need to do is be able to label packets so you can enforce security properties relating to them. So mandatory access control, essentially, I mean, it is what it says. The mandatory access control is all about enforcing mandatory policies. So normally, there are a set of mandatory policies in the Unix in Unix-like environments, and a set of discretionary mechanisms. Discretionary mechanisms allow users to protect their own objects. When you create a file system object, you are given the right to set permissions on it. You are given the right to move it around and do all these other things and rename it. And there, that set of rights is purely discretionary. The administrator isn't really involved in the protection process there. And one of the downsides to that kind of model, especially with Unix permissions and even worse with ACLs, is that it's very hard to manage all those protections. And it's solely at the discretion of the user. Mandatory access control tries to address that by allowing the administrator to define policies regarding users in the system and the objects that they create. And so in environments, for example, like large web service providers where you have many customers on the same machine, or university environments and you have many users on the same machine, and you need something a little bit more reliable than discretionary access control, it's very easy for users to leave the wrong permissions on files, to share things they shouldn't, to rely on things they shouldn't, and mandatory access control permits the administrator to design policies that try and restrict what happens in the system. There are a couple of traditional mandatory access control policies which are relatively widely deployed in military environments and in trusted operating systems, and I think it is arguable that many users would have limited use for these, and so there are a couple of other policies that are also relevant. The two policies off the top of my head that are most commonly deployed are multi-level security, which is a confidentiality and sensitivity policy. What it allows you to do is express policies about who is allowed to read or write what based on information flow. It allows you to say, these objects have a high classification, these users have a low clearance, and therefore they are not allowed to read those objects. Very popular in military environments, but also popular in some commercial environments and for places like the banking industry. The sort of strict hierarchical model is there are levels and so on, but in fact, many implementations include categories, which is really about doing things based on the need to know kind of model. There's a policy very similar to it called the BIBA integrity policy, which is about system integrity as opposed to confidentiality, and it assigns integrity labels to objects and integrity labels to subjects. And if you're a low-integrity subject, you aren't able to modify high-integrity objects. And if you're a high-integrity subject, you're not allowed to read low-integrity objects. And you want an example of that in the system in a very limited form already of secure levels. Secure levels assigns high integrity to certain kinds of objects and doesn't allow low-integrity subjects to modify them. Now, secure levels aren't a comprehensive access control mechanism. They don't offer a coherent policy because they prevent only movement in one direction. They prevent a subject that is running at low integrity, i.e. with a high secure level, from touching an object that is high integrity, that is, has the system change flag. But it doesn't prevent the kernel or the early boot process from touching files that are low integrity, so it isn't, you know, entirely coherent. And the BIBA integrity policy allows you to adapt to that. And many trusted systems ship with the base system at high integrity and additional objects at low integrity, and so even if you get compromised root or something, you can't actually touch some of the base system objects. That obviously requires lots of configuration, requires a lot of work and identification of components. Many people find something called type enforcement much more useful, which is a flexible mandatory access control mechanism where the administrator defines rules. And so the goal of the mandatory access control framework we've had is to actually allow you to plug in many different models. I, for example, have a model called the BSD extended model, which is like a firewall set of rules that it tells you which users are allowed to touch objects owned by which other users. And so, for example, you can assert that certain users will never modify objects with certain groups, which can be useful if you have customers who aren't allowed to touch stuff from other customers and things like that. Mandatory access control requires pervasive enforcement, which means that you have to be able to enforce these on many kinds of objects and in many kinds of places. So, for example, our current framework allows you to enforce policies relating to normal subjects, processes, and file system objects like files and directories, but also allows you to restrict access to interfaces. For example, you can forbid users from going out using certain interfaces to do certain kinds of things. It allows you to mark packets, so you can carry packets with labels through the system and enforce security policies based on how you label the packets. Sockets, you can prevent some processes from talking to other processes based on whatever policy you choose. It's worth noting there are some application issues there. What the modular framework does is provide a single extensible framework that you can plug these into. You can plug in multiple modules at a time. You can plug them in at runtime and introduce new policies. Some policies don't lend themselves to being introduced at runtime. For example, these sort of more complex labeled policies like military security models and so on aren't really things you want to load at runtime. They're things you have to configure your whole system for. But other models, such as things that resemble the JL model, the extended BSD model, those can be loaded at runtime fine, and then they can be unloaded again later. So this doesn't replace the existing security code in the system. It only really provides the ability to restrict current things in the system. You know, a logical next step might be to allow you to replace components of the existing policy, but that has a much higher level of complexity and a much higher cost, and so that's not something we're working on just yet. The modular framework provides a series of API calls. You scatter references to the API calls through the system when objects are created, when accesses occur. Right now, these calls are ifdefed with a Mac ifdef, which is from Options Mac, and that allows you to enable this. The theory goes that this prevents the cost of these calls from affecting normal kernel operation, and therefore if you compile without Options Mac, you don't actually pay the cost of all this. Talk about to what extent that's true. In some cases, we've added some additional space structures and so on, which previously wasn't there. And then after you pay the initial cost of the API calls and the call into the subsystem, calls out to individual modules add additional cost. And so to some extent, that cost depends on the policy you want to enforce. What happens with the module framework is when the system comes up, a module can either declare itself at boot time using a linker set, in which case it registers itself early in the boot process. And so it can begin to enforce the new objects as they become available in the system, or you can load it using a local kernel module later. So you can go ahead and KLD load whatever. You know, I have a baby audit module which plugs into the kernel and begins to monitor access checks and spits them out of the device. So what happens is you're going to the API, and then inside there's a sort of a demux process where you call out to the various modules, and the result is composed. Currently the composition is, if any module says it's a bad idea, it's a bad idea. It won't be allowed to happen. Modules don't have to implement everything, and so you don't pay the cost if a module doesn't touch the network system. You don't go into the network component of the module. So right now, these API calls are in a purport branch, and they're scattered relatively pervasively through the system. They don't enforce on every operation we're interested in. They don't necessarily touch every component of the system. There are big parts of the system where, because we don't use them, we haven't adapted them. For example, the APM stack hasn't been adapted yet. The AppleTalk stack has actually been adapted, although there hasn't been much testing going on for that. So we've implemented the sort of composition component where you call into the Mac mechanism, and then it composes the results of them. When you're updating security labels on objects, it's sort of a two-phase commit. You ask every module, is it okay? And then the modules that care say yes or no, and the ones that don't care don't say anything. And then you go ahead and perform the update after you've done that and ask every module, which means that you get some interesting composition properties if you load multiple modules. There isn't a generic label structure. There is a single structure which is present, and when you want to add new models that require new label space on objects, you actually have to recompile your kernel to add space to them. But the ones that don't require new label space don't need that. Eventually, we hope to move towards a more generic mechanism, but the real key there is to avoid adding lots of cost by making things extensible, which is one of the concerns with the MBUF extensibility mechanism. You want to be able to add flexibility, but you really don't want to introduce new memory allocation in the fast path on network processing. Which actually is something that's feasible now that we have fine-grained SMP and interrupt threads, but still is undesirable. We don't currently allow for garbage collection of the contents of many of these labels, and probably ought to at some point, if they point into other things. Right now, it's just a binary blob that gets carried around. We haven't done a whole lot of work to integrate this mechanism into userland. I can talk a little bit about some examples, and these are the examples that I had on my slides that's the work in progress. For example, one of the components of the ongoing work has been to try and improve the structure for access control in the kernel. For example, previously, before we started, there were at least 6 or 7 different places where access control checks were performed for debugging, and every one of them was different. They all expressed the policy differently. If you used one interface, you could debug processes. You couldn't debug with another interface. And depending on, you know, it was pretty bad. Those are all now centralized, and they're causing John a great time with fine-grained SMP. What we've done is added the hooks inside of those calls in the case of processes. So the CRCANC call, which allows credentials to check whether or not they're allowed to debug a process owned with another credential, just gets a little ifdef MAC in the middle with an additional call out with a failure case. Inside of each module, inside of the API, there's then a MAC credCANC, which goes out and calls out to each module that's interested in expressing an opinion on the topic. And then it composes, it just looks for a failure mode, and if there's a failure, it fails. And then modules will implement a per-module version of the same call if they care. Otherwise, they'll have a null pointer in their array of call-outs. And they'll go ahead and perform whatever check is appropriate for them. They might look at the label. They might look at the credential. They might look at the time of day. They might pull something out of the random number generator, you know, wherever it is. But the goal is to provide some flexibility.
Can I ask you a question?
Sure.
Does this flexibility extend to actually removing the existing checks?
No, it doesn't. This only composes with existing checks by restricting. There's a limited number of things you can express with this. They're all useful things, at least I'd like to think so. But this doesn't, for example, allow you to replace the current permissions check. It only allows you to extend the current permissions check, protection check by adding a new ability to return an error previously. We talked about taking it beyond that, and probably will experiment with that. I think this is going to be much more production-worthy than that, because for one thing, that may have added security penalties, and also, with the mandatory checks, you can do them above the per file system code and the VFS common file system code. in order to augment the discretionary checks, you have to modify the file systems because the checks are pretty deep within the file system. It's easy to restrict things above the file system. It's hard to add additional rights.
I had a request from some people who may have got some embedded stuff, and they would like to have the access checks on files removed, but leave them intact on processes.
People run Windows 2000 in that configuration all the time. They run with a FAT file system, and yet they run with the access control of the kernel turned on. Eventually, that might be something that's possible if we broaden it to allow you to replace existing checks, in which case you could just simply say, we don't do any, we just always return success. And that may indeed be something to look for. One of the other benefits, if you could allow existing checks to be removed, would be that you could take the cost of existing checks out of the runtime stack for a number of operations. But I think there's a lot more work to do before we can get there. So the directions we're going in basically at this point are improve the flexibility, add more hooks into the Mac API so that you can call out to more places in the kernel and perform more checks. We want to migrate some of the other work we've done, like Lomac, inside of this framework gradually. It'll probably take a while, and there's a lot of work to do. And we need to teach userland how to deal with the fact that models will change in the kernel and there are new labels it might need to know about.
I remember you talking a lot about you were concerned about terrorist checks only being done at open time. Are you moving it to a per operation?
Right now,
I don't have a problem with it.
Yeah.
Stuff, I was just wondering,
right now, we only implement it. The Mac framework only does at open time. We plan to make it before possible to do this at read, write, send, and receive, and so on. That has some fascinating VM interactions. For example, when you change the protection on an object, you might have to flush all the VM mappings to it and allow them to come back again so you can segfault processes that have them mmapped. There are some very interesting pieces of behavior related to file flags, which actually already do it at read and write. The append flag in the FFS actually does perform a check with every write. And if you mmap a file, and then at different points you might set the append flag, you get utterly different failure modes. If you set the flag in the first place, you can't open it writable, and you can't mmap it writable. If you set the flag after you've opened it, mmap might still get restricted. If you set the flag after you've mmapped it, but before you've touched the page, then you can get a segfault. But if you set the flag after you've touched the page, then the page reference is cached, and when you set the flag, you can still touch the page, even though it might be appending to the file.
You cannot set the flag.
What you can do is you can. What happened is I have a test case for this. I think append will prevent you from allocating the blocks even if you extended the file. I don't know.
Now attending.
Brooks Davis.
Depending what order you do it in. If you touch the page, your segfault to the flag is it.
Now departing.
Thomas Mester.
If you have a file, you need to come across.
Yeah, and I think I don't remember if the append flag prevents you from using those or. But there's a very cute case where sometimes you'll segfault and sometimes you won't. It all depends on whether you've touched the page yet.
Okay,
the point where the flag changes.
Is this a good thing or a bad thing? What are you doing?
Okay, so right now, that's an interesting thing. Really, you should flush if you want the. Okay, so what we're doing right now is we enforce it open. We would like to change it so we can enforce it at other points. We don't plan to change existing security models like permissions to enforce at other points because then some of the cached access models wouldn't work properly. If you want the sys-change flag and the append flag to work properly, you have to flush the mappings on the file and allow them to be re-faulted back in again as part of the VM operation. And at that point, vot-read and vot-write will fail, and so you'll segfault the application. So in theory, you can implement these things at read-write, but for normal models, you probably don't want to. Bad things would happen. There are also performance questions. For example, one thing we might do once we've added the ability to restrict read and write is to make that something that's compile time decided. So in the normal case, you could choose to run the system without read and write protections from any models so as to not get the performance in. Enforcing it open isn't too bad because open is relatively expensive anyway. But enforcing every read and write for high performance applications could be a problem.
The other reason why it sort of comes up is you may detect an intrusion in progress. And if you may have opened something that you don't want.
Once we have read and write have interception on it, then we will be able to support revocation. So when you change the label on the file, you will be able to revoke access.
Now attending.
Thomas Mester.
There actually is some code to do that in the Boston
Revoke currently works. We were talking about this with Kirk. Revoke currently only works on TTYs, and what it does is
devices.
Right. Yeah, it works generally on devices. It goes through and it replaces it with a bad VOP or whatever. It VGONs it. But it only allows it to operate on devices right now. But actually, in general, you might not want to revoke all access to a vNode. You might want to restrictively revoke access to the vNode, and that's something that we can't revoke all the time too. Everyone loses it.
It's also very unsafe. It will go and replace your function pointer set right in the middle of an operation.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a very interesting. It's also kind of fun to run. I sat there and I ran revoke on a bunch of devices on my system I don't normally run it on. Very fun things happen. try revoking access to your root vNode for your root device, Podgen device. Very good stuff.
Don't do that.
It doesn't crash. Isn't that good?
Okay.
No, it actually doesn't crash. Like, you know, you start getting fault errors and the file system starting really odd things and it doesn't crash. It's great.
I already get that in current,
right? okay, so I guess we got to the end of the introduction, and we can go to more questions. Currently, we would like very much to commit this to the 5.0 tree before current goes out the door. It's not yet ready to commit. It needs cleaning up. It needs more enforcement points and so on. It's available in Purpose right now on a branch, and presumably at the point where we start thinking about actually committing it to the main tree and not just the infrastructure for it, we'll start running patches around and all that stuff. You can also get to it from CVSUP 10. Teacher has kindly arranged for Purpose to export itself via CVSUP. So those who want to get to it that way can do that.
Does it break current for a week when you integrate it?
Probably not. I mean, a lot of it, I mean, assuming that we merge it properly, no. Because options Mac will not be in generic, at least it's not in the picture we currently have.
So the kernel recompile?
A kernel recompile would turn it on, then you would break it. Yeah. the real concern we have is we don't want to impact performance substantially. And the question, what we haven't done is the micro-benchmarking yet to know whether or not the hooks that we've scattered, for example, on the network stack, are going to seriously impede performance. If they do, you know, the argument is clear that you leave it off. But if they don't seriously impede it, we're actually tempted to leave it on because you can do some pretty cool things. Like, the same way you can KLD load IPFW, you can KLD load Mac BSD extended and then assert that some users can't touch certain files and things like that. You can also plug certain kinds of auditing functionality in.
The buff potential is amazing.
Yes. That's one of the reasons I wrote the BSD extended model, because sometimes users do things I don't like, and there's no way to stop them without, like, revoking access to their accounts. You can't say, don't touch files owned by this group. There's no way to do that. And this will allow you to do that. Any questions from anyone other than Paul Hennig?
One other thing. There may be papers on this, but something that sort of struck me as interesting with video. You know, there's that program called Tripwire, and it's more interesting to have an active mode Tripwire, such that when you some process may record itself as a possible entry point into the system, and when you do, and then you can flag certain things like root.rook or something, as you know, don't touch that file unless you know what you're doing, kind of thing. You can basically track up and detect the point of giving the whole fuse machine. I think I talked to you about this earlier.
Yeah. And you can do a number of things like that with the current framework. It will allow you to do that. It will allow you, for example, one of the things you can do is you can use extended attributes in the place to store labeling information. So you could write a module that plugs in an object that have a certain extended attribute set at open time. A check will be performed to see if the current subject is really supposed to touch an object with that extended attribute set, and when that happens, you take the behavior of your choice. You could fail the access. You could crash the system. You know, whatever really makes you feel happy. So you can do that with the current framework.
I'm mentioning Tripwire. One of the things I would like to use extended attributes for is to store a MD5 best effort MD5 checksum on files to make the integrity checks faster. Of course, if you update a block in the middle of the file, I'm not going to read the entire file to update it. But most file writes are actually sequential, so it would be trivial to maintain an MD5 checksum while the write is going on. When the close happens, store that MD5 checksum right there in the extended attributes in the vNode, making Tripwire and M3 kind of checks much faster because the kernel has the MD5 checksum already.
That's not something you can implement with the current framework. It's certainly something you can use extended attributes for. The reason you couldn't implement it with the current framework is that although you get an event when the open occurs, and you will get events when read and write occur, you want to get access to the read and write data itself, which might be a page flying around via put pages or something like that. But it's certainly something you can use extended attributes for. I think it would be very interesting to look at. Anyone else have anything? This would rely on the ability to, right now, the struct mbuff is extended to include additional labeling information. Eventually, it would be nice if it was a generic mechanism to tag things onto mbuffs as they slid through the system. It would be very nice data to store there.
MAUX.
Well, as long as nobody else reuses MAUX, it's fine.
No. MAUX is supposed to be a linked list of mbuffs with specific information. Just have to make sure you don't clash on any enumeration. And then what I mbuffet is create the mbuffet is walk and then free is called on it.
That's very expensive. Right now, when an mbuffet is instantiated from an interface or from a socket or something, a label will be copied to it. But that's a small data copy operation. To use mbux, you have to allocate new mbuffet templates. In which case, you know, that's pretty expensive to have an IP input. You can do some weird routing stuff now, like you can arrange for packets from some interfaces to never be allowed out other interfaces, even if they pass through applications, or packets can only go out a second interface if they go through an application on the way from the first interface, and all kinds of cute things like that.
You know, what you can actually do is you can allocate the mbuffet, but you don't really have to copy the data because you can store it in a cluster or some sort. Yeah, it is expensive, but it's generic.
Yeah, I think one might lean on the side of generic there, so as not to change struct mbuffet risk. Eventually bumping the size of the mbuffet above 200 gigabytes.
Are we doing time wise?
About
that.
Anything else? Yeah.
You said something about the NSA Linux code?
Yes.
Is that going to be a direct port from the Linux, or is it going to be independently developed code so that it's under BSD license?
The licensing question is a fascinating question. Sometime we should sit down and talk about that. there are at least two copyrights on the SE Linux code. There is the NSA copyright, and there's an NAI Labs copyright. And fortunately, we work for NAI Labs, and the contract is to port it over. And so the NAI Labs stuff, my understanding is there'll be no problem changing that to a BSD license. All this stuff that we're doing for the trusted BSD work is under a BSD license. Our current plan is not to change the license on the NSA work, to have that be a separately compiled piece of something, and it can plug into the framework. But all the stuff that sits in between, you know, the Mac framework and so on, will be under a BSD license. So you could independently compile the SE Linux work as a module loaded in. I'm sorry, Terry, you have one thing.
By compiled and loaded in framework, do you mean as like a loaded module?
Yes. One of the things you can do now.
So we'll get around the license issue.
Yeah, I think you could go like that.
So we can actually distribute binaries.
Currently, I don't think we pre-compile kernel modules that are under the GPL. I think they're just in a directory like XQFS. We don't build that by default. I think we'd probably have to work the same way. You could imagine a package which has a kernel module in it. It's really a policy thing. Obviously, we're going to be lobbying NSA to try and change the license on that. I've been exchanged an email on the topic. So. Right now, one of the things you can do which makes it possible to load it as a module is that you can preload the module from the loader the same way we do with ACPI, which means that it's there for the entire lifetime of the kernel, which is necessary for some of the pervasive labeling things. Is that good?
Quick question, I'm meaning to digress on the topic of licenses in any depth, but my understanding from, you know, going to school in this country was that any project that was, you know, basically done by the government had to be released into the public domain. But recently I've been seeing a lot of projects that were, you know, government done, it released as GPL. Is this like accessible to the government, or is it just something that hasn't really counted?
Something I'm not really at liberty to talk about.
Okay.
contractors contribute software under whatever license is acceptable in the negotiation process. Essentially, in our contracts for the CBOS work, which is including the trusted BSD work and the extended attribute work and UFS2 work and all that stuff, we negotiated to release under an appropriate open source license, which in this case means the BSD license, and that was part of our contract. And so contractors can do that kind of thing. The only requirement for the government's perspective for contractors is the government is required to negotiate contracts to allow the government unlimited use. And so you'll see often on software, you'll see special government licensing as part of the license, which has to do with whether or not the work was derived from pieces of software development using government funding.
It's more gray than they had made it sound in elementary school.
Funny that. Yes. that's actually pretty accurate. For things that NAI Labs as a contractor has written, assuming that internally we did make it through the decision process and the sponsor liked it, we can relicense it if we want to. I don't think a final decision has been made on the SE Linux components. We have to be a little bit careful because the stuff which we modified that was GPL, you know, it becomes GPL. But certainly the work necessary to plug it in on the manager access control framework won't be, it'll be the SE license.
Right. One more thing, not about compatibility. I've been working with a bunch of other vendors, and I'm wondering how compatible we are and how that's working. Are they going to move a little more towards us? Because it seems like they were seeking themselves for some of the things that they did, but I'm not sure the specifics on. And by waiting, got a much better system, but I'm wondering if it's actually going to be compatible now.
Compatibility is an interesting question when it comes to security extensions. For the ACL work, we've attempted to remain as much as possible compatible with the failed POSIX 1E spec. And so we implement it, certainly, I think, as well as anybody else does. IRIX also implements it. The Linux implementation does that. I don't remember if HP does. You know, there are bunches of them. Solaris is different. It has the same, many of the same ideas, but it has an entirely different API.
One of the interesting things that maybe perhaps support you, if you could get it open, NFS 8 tended to actually support that Solaris inclusion. I mean, you know,
I think right now every vendor has their own additional RPCs they use for managing ACLs, and they're all incompatible. As you might not be entirely surprised to learn. But for the other components of the work, extended attributes APIs haven't been standardized anywhere. They weren't discussed in POSIX 20 spec, although POSIX 20 speeches are usually implemented on top of extended attributes. We've been trying to work with other vendors to make sure our extended attributes interfaces are similar. We thought we'd succeeded with Linux, and then they changed them all again, and then they added them to their tree, so I guess they're not changing again. I don't know. It's pretty hard to do that kind of thing.
Oh, that's normal. Give them to everyone.
It's harder than to change into what we would use. That would be true. I changed mine several times to match up with theirs, and then they changed theirs to look more like mine, and then I changed mine to do some things, and they changed theirs to do some things, and then everything looked fine, and then they added them to the tree, and they were different.
Okay.
We tried.
I've heard you say this thing about the failed projects, blah, blah, you spent so many times. And it sounds to me like it's almost getting better adopted and more faithfully adopted.
Since it wasn't made into a standard.
Yes.
Certainly, I could believe that.
Is there a lesson to be learned here?
The lesson to be learned is if you put it in an open source operating system, that's a good substitute for a standard. Many commercial vendors are now doing things because that's the way Linux does them. And the trick is to make sure Linux does them the right way. which we won't go into great detail. I won't talk about that. For some of the other interfaces, the manager access control interfaces and so on, there are some failed standards and even some successful standards on how you do those things, but none of them deal very well with the notion that you might have pluggable policy. Almost all of them assert that you have a single system policy, and so we will try and meet the APIs in as much as possible, but for example, the manager access control API they provide is almost meaningless, in part because one of the reasons POSIX 20 failed, I mean, talking to a lot of the people involved, was that all the vendors would get together and say, it has to do what I want, which is not unusual for a standards process, and then they would all go apart and they do something different, and then they'd come back and the API would end up being completely generic. You could express anything using this API. It has no meaning at all, and that's kind of what they ended up with for the Mac stuff. And the audit stuff, I guess, similarly, you can do anything with the audit framework. Unfortunately, none of it will be high performance, and so those vendors that do support the POSIX 20 audit API tend to do so in user land, and they don't use it within the kernel, and they don't have a library with wraps that makes it look like POSIX 20. And we'll probably provide that. Any other questions? We're probably about out of time on my slot. We've been on a little bit over. Okay. Sounds good. Brian, do you want to talk about capabilities, or you'd rather not? Probably rather not.
I'm not saying. There's
other work going on. We're not sure quite what to do with it.
We have the POSIX capability tree, and it's largely complete and stable. The only thing is we don't know if it has any real performance hit.
I know it has performance hit.
Okay. Well, we don't know how much. We don't know how much of a performance hit it has for a lot of operations, and we don't know if it's something that will generally be useful, considering that the POSIX 20 capabilities, as specified, are very coarsely grained, and
it was an experimental implementation, and we've done it, and we have it running. And
if anyone's familiar with it and thinks that it may be a good thing to have, then
they should let us know, and then maybe we can integrate it.
So why would anybody be looking for the NSA to load a module that has NSA in it on their system?
So you don't have to load the SE Linux and SE DSD module. There are many other useful things you can load into it. For example, on Linux, they now have this thing called Linux security modules, which essentially provides a lot of this, maybe with less semantics, maybe with less locking, I don't know, but it's different. Many, 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 many more hooks. But part of the goal was that they had a lot of different vendors who were doing security research work and security development work. They had the OpenWall people who had patches of the Linux kernel. They had people doing type enforcement work. They had the SE Linux people. They had the LIDS people. And they wanted to provide something so that many of these people didn't have to have local patch sets, which were hard to maintain and hard to distribute and hard to use. And my anticipation is that having a framework like this will actually probably enable more work if people want to do other things. And so having the framework in the system is very useful. Whether or not you load the stuff that comes from NSA, entirely up to you. There have actually been a lot of people looking at it, and I'm pretty impressed. There are probably fewer vulnerabilities in it than some of the other security code I've seen coming out of places that aren't NSA. So,
well, I'm just wondering.
You can make your own decision on that one.
Well, I'm just wondering if vulnerabilities are on purpose.
As far as I know, no one has found anything. They did find a buffer overflow in one of the libraries supporting the SE Linux work, and it was fixed within a day of it getting reported. So,
another backdoor in your system.
Yeah.
All those modules for discussion crafted as far as.
Yeah. Well. I mean, obviously, we're not going to load the code into the none of this. I mean, the MAC framework will be in the kernel, but that's. I mean, NSA didn't pay for that, and NSA didn't write it, and you can decide whether you trust it or not. And the other stuff can be doesn't have to be loaded, so you don't have to run X2FS on your kernel either if you don't want to.
Okay.